RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Kiwi Dr. Greg Simons is a former associate professor at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Uppsala University, where he taught at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research, namely the course on mass media and contemporary armed conflict. He's now an associate professor at Tariba University, Latvia. His research interests include changing political dynamics and relationships, mass media, public diplomacy, political marketing, crisis management and communications, media and armed conflict, and the Russian Orthodox Church. He also researches the relationships and connections between information, politics, and armed conflict more broadly, such as the global war on terror and Arab Spring. So Greg Simons joins us right now. Hi, Greg. Thanks for coming back on again.
G'day, Paul. Pleasure as always.
Okay, I want to get to the very latest in, well, it's a global kind of situation, with in the Middle East, the possibility of an Israeli attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iran threatening an obliterating war if that happens, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu convinced that a major conflict with Iran is inevitable because he believes that the Iranians have plans to conquer the entire Middle East. The Americans have assets off the coast of Lebanon, and I think the Saudis are advising their people to get out of that particular area. Then you have Ukraine, Russia. There have been some developments over the weekend. Two elections, the general election in the UK, Labour won, Tories decimated, Farage in. And yesterday we learned from exit polls from the French elections predicting the left-wing alliance will get the most seats but fall short of an absolute majority. President Macron's centrist group will get second most seats and Marine Le Pen's national rally the third most. In other words, no party will be able to form a government alone based on these results. So who governs France will depend on the outcome of coalition negotiations. And the far left seeming the most likely outcome at this stage. And then there's the status of the current US president. Will he remain or will he be changed out? And if so, we wonder with who and what that all means. So a lot happening, Greg.
Yeah.
First of all, though, Greg, I want to get to some incoming communications we've had. This is after our last chat a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about Israel-Gaza pretty well. We got a number of them, but I'm going to read out just one as an example, because sure, it's fair enough they've written in, and you're right here with us now. Okay. From Graham, Paul, I realize there is a value in having counterviews aired on RCR, but there should be some context offered. It appears that Greg has interesting connections that would be good to know as a listener. Seems that he is a member of the pro-Kremlin and pro-Assad working group in Syria, propaganda and media, and has organized pro-Putin meetings in Uppsala University. He was also an invited observer of the 2019 Russian elections by the ruling administration. While he is perfectly at liberty to do these things, it does indicate a potential for a particular bias that as participants of a balanced media outlet, we should be informed of, my opinion anyway. Seems like, Graham says, rather than a specialist in propaganda studies, he might be better identified as a study in propaganda expertise. Example, still battering on about a genocide in Gaza, where the population is warned before the IDF attack. Sounds like a very clever way to go about a genocide, whatever you might think of the ethics of that war. Offered in the spirit of balanced journalism, thanks for all the great work you are all doing. Super appreciated, Graham. All right, response to that, Greg.
Okay, there are many things to unpack from Graham's point. A lot of it is speculative and opinionated. For example, what is a pro-Putin rally at Uppsala University? I can't say that I have ever given a pro-Putin rally, whatever that may be.
So he's looked something up on the net probably and seen an opinion from someone.
Well, I mean, this is the problem, that on the one hand, people can take things with a grain of salt, what they hear from mainstream media, but, oh, it's on the internet, it must be true. No, not at all. And judging by the exact words he uses, I understand where he got that from. This fake Observer's website, which is run by a Ukrainian who's writing in these Euro-Atlanticist narratives. Anyone who diverges from those becomes Putinist, an apologist of Putin, Assad, etc., etc., etc. I mean, this is what Socrates said. I mean, when the argument is lost, one resorts to name-calling and character assassination. And I mean, this is what it is. I mean, I've encountered this individual a number of times. He offers nothing beyond trying to assassinate the character of people who stand out, giving other views than what Washington offers. So, I mean, yeah, and okay, so also I do detect the, what do you say, the propaganda of the lie of omission. Okay, yeah, Israel does warn the Palestinians, you should evacuate this territory and go to that territory. But then the next part is missing. They bomb the hell out of that territory, and it's been recorded again and again and again. This is not only in media, but this is in the UN. This is across the board. They are bombing the living daylights out of civilian targets, which is against the rules of war. It's against humanitarian law. It's against every ethical and moral code under the sun. So, no, you got the International Court of Justice. They ruled that there is a plausible genocide. But this is not only about genocide, it's about ethnic cleansing, because what are they doing in West Bank? They are dispossessing Palestinians of their property. But everything's in Gaza. So, I mean, what is this? As he says, you're entitled to your opinion, and you've had those in history who say, well, I disagree with what you have to say, but I will give my life defending your right to say it. So maybe to learn to be a little bit more tolerant to other views that might not fit your worldview, and it might create a much more balanced understanding why things happen the way they do and when they do.
I was just thinking as you're talking there, it's kind of difficult for people, I'm not being patronizing, and I have to check myself on this, to be more of a realist these days rather than, a supporter or an apologist or any of those. Whether you like it or not, whether it fits the way you want things to be, you got to keep it real as you can.
Yes, correct. And, I mean, if we look at that in practice today, before I go into the academic definition of realism, we can see, for example, the attitude and actions of Orban versus the rest of the most of the rest of the EU. He is a realist. He's not a Putinist. He's not far right. He's a Hungarian patriot, if you like. I mean, he also experienced the Soviet occupation, so he understands to a certain extent Russian mindset. He speaks Russian. And he visited, after Zelensky, he went straight to Moscow and met Putin. That is a realist. And so what is realism from this perspective? Well, realists, they believe that the world is a chaotic and dangerous place, and that you need to act according to your interests. National interests, not the interests of the US, not the interests of Russia, your own interests, and that this is done through the accumulation and projection of power and influence. So the ability to get others to do what you want, either by coercion or by non-coercive means. And so, I mean, this is their understanding. If you look at the West in general, they're much more ideological. I mean, because they adhere to this liberalism, they got this number of ideological beliefs, and that this trumps all else. So the pursuit of ideology. So hence, I mean, you had Francis Fukuyama, The End of History, which was this understanding that the world was going to become this monolithic kind of entity in the image of the US, politically, culturally, economically, etc. And so this is what they're after. And, I mean, you've got a number of observers, and this is coming out now, that the current stage of liberalism and liberal democracy focuses much more on enforcing and coercing this ideological understanding of what the liberalism should be at the expense of democracy. And I mean, this is the case across the board. So whether you have Sunak or Starmer in power, whether you have Swedish social democrats or moderates in power, it doesn't really make a difference because in the words of George Galloway, you probably heard this particular quote, they are two cheeks of the same backside.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, keep it real. So let's go to the situation the world is in. I think it's fair to say that. Could involve all of us, though we're nicely tucked away, thankfully. Let's get right up to date with what is happening. First in Europe, there's Ukraine, there's NATO. I think there's a NATO summit coming up very shortly in Washington, D.C. And, of course, the French and UK elections. Greg, let's start with the French elections. Obviously, those, well, on the centre and to the right, I won't say far right because I just don't think it's an accurate description. Those who are not left were very excited with Le Pen's performance, but it was never, it looks like now, going to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, what you have is an unravelling of this, what you would call mainstream establishment politics. I mean, this is the main point, what's happening. These traditional mass political parties are falling apart because they're pursuing what I was discussing a little before, about they're pursuing liberalism at the expense of democracy, and people have had enough. I mean, you saw a similar thing in Britain. Did you know that in Britain, these elections that have just happened is the lowest turnout they ever recorded in terms of voting? 57%.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So, I mean, you have a similar thing in France, of course. And yeah. So what you have, the divide, I mean, it's not so much this old understanding of the political system, this very simplistic left versus right. It's establishment versus non-establishment politics. And Macron represents establishment politics, which the French people have gone through the yellow vests, they've gone through COVID, they've gone through all of these draconian measures, and they've had enough. Which is understandable. And so, I mean, Le Pen, who seemed to be on the way out because she wasn't gaining any real traction in all the other elections, mainly because she isn't what her father was. And there was this kind of attempt at who to replace her with. But now, given this, and I also think from Macron's point of view, he wants to distance himself from the mess that he's created. So if he stands back, oh, look, I'm not running the government. I'm the president, but the government is not my party. So it gives, he tries to think that this will give him some plausible deniability for the clusterfuck that's really going to start to evolve now, because the France, I mean, under Macron and earlier, I mean, they were competing with Germany, so for the lead position in the EU, because under Scholz, I mean, Germany's really gone into a deep spiral. So, but with Macron, I mean, he's mismanaged everything. And so I think he kind of thinks that this is his dignified exit. I doubt it. I mean, the French people have spoken. They're against that policy, which establishment politics supports across the board. Doesn't matter if it's left or right. The main divide is not left or right, but establishment versus non-establishment.
Yeah, and I guess for those who supported a national rally, they'll be, what sort of frame of mind do you think they'll be in? Do you think this is going to cause issues, societal issues, in the aftermath of this in France?
No, I mean, it has the potential for those who want to start something. I mean, we've seen what that, how that works in the United States, for example, when the wrong candidate wins an election. So I think, I mean, there is the potential to start it. But I think a great number of people just want to see Macron gone. I mean, he's one of these WEF children, so and the politics that represents, they want to. It's really, I mean, a big vote against Macron. I think more than for Le Pen, because Le Pen is the visible opposite of everything that Macron stands for and his politics.
Okay, in the UK general election, Labour wins. What's your take on that?
Those who think that Labour won, in British Labour won the election, are sadly mistaken. Because they actually lost the absolute number of votes. What has happened is you've seen a complete and utter implosion of the Conservatives instead. So, I mean, you've got this politics which, I mean, people were reacting to things that they don't like to see more of, because you had Sunak pursuing this very dangerous foreign policy. I mean, overseeing the economic destruction of what was left of the UK. I mean, the same with France and Macron. I mean, Macron, I mean, this was the parliamentary, not the presidential elections, but it was still directed at him. So what you have is a very, I mean, people are not voting for the best candidate. They're voting against the worst candidate is what you're seeing. But the EU will continue to do the same, because you just see the reaction to Orban. I mean, oh no, you're talking with the guy we call the enemy. I mean, we want unity. In other words, we want to continue the same idiotic policy that is driving what many are talking about towards a possible nuclear war.
Yeah, so Viktor Orban, Prime Minister of Hungary, he met with Vladimir Putin in Moscow over the weekend. That seemed to go well. And that was just after, I think a few days ago, he met with Zelensky in Kyiv. Okay, there was the public face of that, and there was quite a bit of talk to the press and in public. But he had been to see Zelensky before that, right?
Yes. Correct.
And I saw Zelensky the other day, and he looked scared. He really did. He had, you know, he had the body language and look of a scared man. They're at the limit, and he's also been making comments about, you know, casualties. I think he's sort of just starting to sort of mention that, and also saying, I think, 14 brigades, we have 14 brigades, no weapons. So you can feel a desperation, if you triangulate it all.
Yep.
In those talks with Putin behind closed doors, he would have relayed to Putin what Zelensky was willing to do, right? That would have been what happened, surely?
I would say that's quite plausible. Of course, I mean, it's conjecture, but it's plausible conjecture because, I mean, Orban is doing what France failed to do, which is why Macron is so angry at Orban.
Jumping up and down,
because, I mean, he's had what he thought was his moment in the spotlight absolutely ripped away, because Macron is not taken seriously by Russia or the United States, the main players in this. Excuse me. So, I mean, what Orban has done is because, of course, Hungary has a stake in this because they're bordering Ukraine. And not only do they border Ukraine, they rely on Russian energy suppliers. And, of course, there's to have a functional relationship with them to keep the economy alive, and also the Hungarian minority in Ukraine, which is under a lot of pressure at the moment by the Ukrainian authorities, which are extremely nationalistic in character. And, of course, if Zelensky collapses, which he very likely will, it just depends which source takes him out first.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think this is what he's beginning to understand, that he has no good way out of this. And there are only which bad option do you want to choose or have chosen for you? And I think now he's at that kind of decision point. Do I let fate deal with me, or do I try to get some kind of minimal deal where I keep my life? So, of course, I mean, under those circumstances, you'd be extremely worried. He's been, as I mean, Mearsheimer said, he's been led down the primrose path. And now the consequences are about to be met, and the, should we say, the invoice will be paid in full.
Ooh, gosh, what an awkward situation. Yeah. And then you've got to explain all those deaths that many people, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people, will blame you directly for. That's heavy.
Yes.
Now, Orban was there because I think Hungary has the rotating
EU presidency.
Presidency, but he was the only guy who'd go anyway, wasn't
he? Yes. Yeah. And the funny thing is what the response you get, because Orban never said he is representing the EU. He said he's representing Hungary. But then you get these puppets from, like the Swedish one, who is, shall we say, a few sandwiches short of a picnic. And he pops up and goes, oh, we must have unity. Orban's breaking unity and he does not represent the EU. Well, he said he does not represent the EU. But this is the kind of infantile stuff you get. They're not listening. They just want to blah, 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 and stay on narrative. And, I mean, the narrative is so, I mean, it's a train wreck. It can't be salvaged. But still, I mean, this is the effects of this ideological blinkering, which they cannot see out of it.
I think they're going to thank Orban massively at some point. Putin, I think, has come out and responded to the post-debate kind of aftermath, and I think I saw a clip of him saying that he understood that President Trump wanted to end this thing, and if he, you know, if he's elected, we'll be talking, and that sounds good to us, was the feeling I got. I can't remember the exact words he used. So he's sort of put that mark on it now too, and he's really sent a message to the American electors, hasn't he, that if you don't want a war, you know who to vote for.
Yes. Oh, no. I mean, because, I mean, by this stage, I mean, Biden has become like a mega parody. And, I mean, when your own ideological apparatus turns against you, you understand that the end is near. So, I mean, taking it from a perspective, what is the most likely outcome, and the strategies before the election, I mean, Joe Biden, for some reason, I don't know why, thinks keeping two wars going, running up to an election, is an election-winning strategy. I mean, it's beyond delusional. Yeah, the US public, I think, has had enough, and, I mean, you've got, like in Europe, the rising cost of living, you've got inflation, you've got all of these things, and, of course, the killer, the price of petrol at the pumps, which is the one that really decides things big time there.
Hmm. Yeah, okay, teetering, tottering to hopefully, you know, not the worst case anyway. All right, I want to look at the bigger picture now with you, and the big question, are we heading towards global war? Is it rapidly approaching? I say rapidly approaching because I'm looking at a piece from the End of the American Dream website, and this is a list of 10 items by Michael Snyder, in his new book, Chaos, 10 Signs That Global War Is Rapidly Approaching. And he says, we're on the verge of an apocalyptic global war in which billions of people could die. Very few people anticipated that World War I would erupt, but it happened anyway. And very few people anticipated that World War II would erupt, but it happened anyway. All throughout human history, he says, there have been wars. Ever since the very beginning, it's just been a matter of time before major powers collide. Unfortunately, even though very alarming warning signs are flashing all around us, most of the population of the Western world seems absolutely clueless about what is really going on out there. Leaders all over the planet seem to have come down with a really bad case of war fever, and preparations for apocalyptic showdowns are being made. The following are 10 signs that global war is rapidly approaching. His first sign is Politico reporting that Israel and Hezbollah have both drafted battle plans, and the Biden administration is convinced that intense fighting is likely to break out. Then Iran is warning that there will be an obliterating war if the IDF enters southern Lebanon. Then number three, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is convinced that a major with Iran is inevitable because he believes that the Iranians have plans to conquer the entire Middle East. Number four, according to NBC News, the U.S. is moving military assets into position so that they can be ready to evacuate Americans once all-out war erupts between Israel and Hezbollah. Then five, on Thursday, and this is from the week of June 30th, Hezbollah sent approximately 40 rockets into northern Israel. Six, on Saturday of that week, Israeli aircraft bombed several Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. Seven, he says, I know I wrote about this last week, but I couldn't leave this particular item out of the article. Apparently, Joe Biden is thinking about approving a plan that would allow U.S. military contractors to deploy to Ukraine. Eight, Russian President Vladimir Putin is reportedly interested in developing a coalition of nations that would rival the West and NATO. Nine, Putin is also warning that Russia will need to begin production of intermediate-range nuclear weapons systems. And 10, a very influential figure in Russian foreign policy circles, and that is Dmitry Suslov, is suggesting that the Russians should actually detonate a nuclear device in order to show the world how serious they are. And he says, unfortunately, all of this is happening at a time when 72% of U.S. voters believe that the guy with the finger on the nuclear button does not have the mental or cognitive health to serve as president. And probably that figure similar here. So, Greg, let's go through some of those 10 points. Israel and Hezbollah both drafted battle plans. Biden administration is convinced that intense fighting is likely to break out. So that's what Michael Snyder says in his book, Chaos. And that's right, isn't it?
It's partially right. But the United States, I don't know if you'd call them plans. That I'm not sure what they're doing with regards to that region, the Middle East. But they, of course, the calculation from Netanyahu's point of view, is to drag the United States into a war because Israel has insufficient power to do it itself. If you look at the recent statement of Gallant, the defense minister in Israel, it was very interesting. He said the necessity and the urgency to recruit 10,000 soldiers into the IDF, they're 10,000 short. So, I mean, is a nice little gem because you don't get any idea what the IDF are losing in Gaza. And obviously, it's many more than they're prepared to say publicly, because if they do, I mean, politically, they are dead. So Israel lacks the military capacity to defeat even Hamas like this. But they want to start a war with Hezbollah. And, of course, they've been attacking these countries, Lebanon and Syria, which is violating different rules of war and international law. But, okay, that aside, why would you do that if you can't take on Hamas, which is much less powerful than Hezbollah. And the point is, we know that the US has assets off the coast of Lebanon, and that these are primarily for the evacuation of US citizens. Interestingly, a point came from Saudi Arabia recently, and this was a call for Saudi citizens to not travel to Lebanon and those there to get out. So you have these diplomatic signals which might imply that Israel might get its wish because to go into there. I mean, this is about Netanyahu's political survival. It's not about the survival of Israel. And if we look at how that will play out, I mean, even Israeli generals are saying this is a bad idea because we will lose. But the point is to get the US involved, because the US will not stand aside and let Israel be destroyed physically by those forces. But of course, then this creates a problem, because will Iran and others stand aside and let Hezbollah and Lebanon be destroyed? Quite probably not.
Well, they've promised, and that's another one of his warnings. Iran has promised, or is warning, that there will be an obliterating war. That's the term, an obliterating war if the IDF enters southern Lebanon. So
yes,
they've said that. Obliterating is a carefully chosen word, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, what they're signaling, obliterating, it's like no one wins. I mean, this is like
you
had an obliterating First World War. I mean, you had the stalemate, which went on for years. I mean, change of territory wasn't great, but the exchange of lives was massive.
Could it be something in this timing, just thought of this while you were talking before? So we had a train wreck presidential debate. A lot of people are asking, why did they let him do it? You've had the mainstream media come out and say, this is a train wreck, and he's got to go, and we're in trouble, the Democrats are in trouble, and reversing, totally flipping the narrative on, I've never seen him looking anything better than he is now a couple of weeks ago to this.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, and I mentioned this a few times before on this program, so listeners won't be surprised to hear me say it one more time. Mike Benz, who's a very good commentator, and he's been on this show a few times, made the point that unlike the Hunter Biden laptop story and other Operation Crossfire and all that sort of stuff, Russia, 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 there has been nothing from the so-called security community. There's been no mass-signed letter saying, you know, we have full confidence in Biden and Trump is horrible and all that. That hasn't come out. So I wonder if there's something in the timing there where you've got the so-called security community, intelligence community, which is really the industrial military complex, isn't it? I mean, basically.
It's a branch,
Not wanting Biden to go now, hence no letter, no lobbying, no pushing, no media fronting on that, because they know very shortly
that
this thing is going to come, this conflict between Hezbollah and Israel. Israel's going to take them on. And you can't have someone, first of all, you can't have a president, if you want that to happen, who will stop it. But on the other hand, you can keep a useful, and I don't want to call him an idiot because the guy's obviously got a medical problem, in place just long enough that someone else who is sort of hovering above the decision-making that the actual president can't make can make a call or make things happen. So this happens. Do you think there's something in that?
Well, I'd say so, because, I mean, I was watching that, and even CNN was saying he should go. I mean, I've never heard CNN talk about this.
Right, right.
And, I mean, New York Times, etc. The silence of the, shall we say, intelligence community is much more telling than if they said something. Because
they don't want him gone now. They don't want him gone right now, is what that tells me.
No, I mean, so in this respect, I mean, they're caught between a rock and a hard place, and they don't, I mean, it's problematic if they put their say in, because this will fracture even more the political elite, and their, I mean, this consensus could well be broken on these different wars, etc. So, I mean, they're probably playing a waiting game and playing out what they can while they can. So this would be their strategy, because to say it publicly might incur some kind of unpredictable and unwanted political backlash and consequences.
All right. So just carrying on with these signs, you mentioned, well, I mentioned that Iran has threatened what they call, what did I say? It was an obliterating war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he's convinced that a major war with Iran is coming because he thinks Iran have plans to conquer the entire Middle East. The entire Middle East?
No. I mean, if we look, there has only been one country in the Middle East that has been consistently conquering and annexing other territory in the Middle East, and that is the only democracy in the Middle East. They're the only ones that have been doing it. So,
Okay. You mentioned the U.S. assets off the coast of Lebanon. That's apparently there to evacuate Americans if it kicks off. But it gives them capability because some of the vessels are purpose-built for landing craft and for special ops. Also, he says, and just to remind people, I'm just taking these points from a book by Michael Snyder called Chaos. And this part of it is headed up 10 signs that global war is rapidly approaching. So after that, Hezbollah has sent rockets into northern Israel, and then Israeli aircraft bombed several Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon, apparently a building where a high-powered meeting was taking place, so on and so forth. And moving off Gaza, Israel, Joe Biden is thinking about approving a plan that would allow, we're back to Ukraine now, U.S. military contractors to deploy to Ukraine. So that would be, what, retired servicemen or servicemen pulled out of the actual service, put into some kind of contractor group and sent basically as U.S. servicemen. So that's what that means, right?
I think this already is happening because, I mean, you're having all these missiles striking targets across Russia. These are complex systems, and they will not be having Ukrainians operating them because you're using US codes and things to target them. Why would you hand that over to the Ukrainians? It doesn't make sense, especially if you know the Ukrainians are infiltrated by Russia.
Yeah, totally.
Because that would go directly to Russia. I mean, this is just an attempt to, what would you say, justify and something that is already in existence. I mean, it's like if we go back to 2014-15, the debate whether to give, how do they call it, lethal aid to Ukraine to fight the what was happening in Donbass. Of course, they were already sending it. And, I mean, there was one article in a Ukrainian newspaper where the US did an audit of the so-called lethal aid. That is different small arms and mostly, so assault rifles, machine guns, anti-tank, et cetera, et cetera. So they did an audit. They found that at least a third of those supplies could not be accounted for. This was a US audit. But, I mean, it's the irony and you couldn't get it better because they traced it down. The Ukrainians sold it to Assad to fight against the US proxies in Syria.
Gosh, yeah. Crazy. Okay, Russian President Vladimir Putin reportedly interested in developing a coalition of nations that would rival the West and NATO. You can understand that. Yeah. As another sign. And Putin also warning that Russia will need to begin production of intermediate-range nuclear weapons systems. Obviously, you can see why they would want to do that. And here's the other thing. Like you're talking about washing machine chips before. I don't think many people realize, and maybe they've just been listening to the wrong media, you can't count the Russians as unsophisticated. They are top thinkers. They have the resources, the physical resources. in the ground and in production to make the most sophisticated products, you know, especially in weaponry. They already have more intermediate range nuclear missiles than anyone. So I guess to round off the point of those points he's making is that all this is lining up, and the Western countries, the populations of the Western countries, are kind of unawares. They're in this sort of false bubble. They don't.
Yeah.
And he makes the point that World War One and World War Two started in an unpredictable way, in a sudden way, and this is, seems to be the pattern, more the pattern than not. And we could be right here, right now, or very close at this moment.
Absolutely. And I mean, the thing which isn't really brought out in that article, I mean, the US initiated it because they started cancelling and not renewing all of those nuclear weapons agreements. That was the US initiative. The Russians tried to keep them going, but they were nipped in the bud because the US, with its hubris, thought that it could actually get the better of Russia. And so, I mean, yeah, it's highly problematic. I mean, okay, so the US started it, the Russians continue it. I mean, this is about realism once more, because the US perceived that they could get a more advantageous position to project power and influence because they considered that their weaponry was superior. This is before, I mean, it's proven anything but superior on the Ukrainian battlefield. And, of course, the Russians respond because they, when one country, and this is very much realism again, starts to accumulate its power and influence and assert its national interest at their expense, they react. And Russia, China, Iran, these are all driven by a deep-rooted understanding and practice of realism in international relations.
Yeah. And just to finish up, Putin, I think, has come out and responded to the post-debate kind of aftermath. And I think I saw a clip of him saying that he understood that President Trump wanted to end this thing. And if he, you know, if he's elected, we'll be talking. And that sounds good to us, was the feeling I got. I can't remember the exact words he used. So he's sort of put that mark on it now too. And he's really sent a message to the American electors, hasn't he? That if you don't want a war, you know who to vote for.
Yes. Oh, no, no. I mean, because, I mean, by this stage, I mean, Biden has become like a mega parody. And, I mean, when your own ideological apparatus turns against you, you understand that the end is near. So, I mean, taking it from a perspective, what is the most likely outcome and the strategies before the election, I mean, Joe Biden, for some reason, I don't know why, thinks keeping two wars going running up to an election is a war, is an election winning strategy. I mean, it's beyond delusional. I mean, if he wanted to stand any chance, he would have finished both of these wars a long time ago. Instead, he keeps them going. And I mean, you've got the election. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see just how, I mean, slaughtered the Democrats get in November, because, I mean, this is going to be telling, especially if we keep in mind what has been happening with elections in these other Western countries in Europe, I mean, like the UK and France and so forth. I mean, yeah, the US public, I think, has had enough. And, I mean, you've got the, like in Europe, the rising cost of living, you've got inflation, you've got all of these things, and of course the killer, the price of petrol at the pumps, which is the one that really decides things big time there.
Mm. Yeah, okay, teetering, tottering to hopefully not the worst case anyway. And Greg, before you go, just a comment from you on our Prime Minister Christopher Luxon, who is set to visit the US to attend the NATO summit in Washington. and that's between the 9th and 12th. So that's starting tomorrow, our time here, to focus on, it says here in the story I'm reading, investment and the trading relationship with New Zealand. He'll also take part in the NATO summit, meeting alliance leaders and joining counterparts from Australia, Japan, and Korea in a meeting of the Indo-Pacific Four. I mean, what's someone from the bottom of the world, as far away almost as you can be from NATO activities, doing at this summit, do you think?
Well, I think it's part of this process, which I have been warning about for some time now. And this is, I mean, the destruction of New Zealand's ability to act as a neutral or non-aligned country. I mean, you can be within some of these organizations, like within, broadly speaking, this, what would you say, inactive member of ANZUS, for example, but still be more or less non-aligned because of your foreign policy actions and rhetoric. But I think what this is, I mean, it's this reining in of New Zealand's independence in terms of its foreign policy stance. And this is coming into this idea of realism, that New Zealand acts in its own interests by choosing neither side. They have this strategic ambiguity, this hedging. That is, they feel quite comfortable, and it's in New Zealand's best interest to be security or political aligned with the US, but economically aligned with China. And that maximizes opportunities in both camps. But what this signifies is that New Zealand is going to be brought into this NATO and this global NATO we keep on hearing about, which is being directed against all of the so-called enemies of the US unipolar order. And this is more directed as an instrument against China. And of course, New Zealand will lose its ability. I mean, Winston Peters, I mean, judging by some of his rhetoric and what he's been doing and where he's been going, would also suggest that this is the new line, that it's a much more pro-US, less New Zealand interest-oriented, more towards what the US wants in terms of containing China. And, well, this never goes anywhere good. And the fact that you have someone from New Zealand in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization,
it doesn't make sense.
No.
Yeah. Indo-Pacific, they love saying that. All right. At least we've got a region that's been defined for us. And the other thing, Keir Starmer made a speech yesterday, our time, and he's all in still with Zelensky. He said he's called him and he's pledged, you know, full support to the Ukraine project and to NATO. So no change there, but no surprise, right?
No change, no surprise. I mean, as Galloway said, two cheeks of the same backside.
Yeah.
I mean, this just proves it again. And I mean, it also proves, I mean, Estama also, I think, miscalculates, because I think he thinks that this is like a vote for Labour, but it's not. I mean, the share of Labour votes decreased. You had the lowest voter turnout ever in recorded UK-wide elections. And, I mean, this, I think, is a miscalculation. But, of course, I mean, he has no choice. But I think the problem for him is going to be not if, but when the US drops Ukraine, because Ukraine is an utter liability, and it's not a strategic issue. Israel's the strategic issue, and if anything kicks off, which it looks like increasingly likely given events in Lebanon more recently, for example, Saudi Arabia recalling its citizens from Lebanon, and you have the US ships, these amphibious vessels for evacuating US citizens from Lebanon. I mean, gives every indication that's going to kick off. And when that kicks off, you're going to have idiots like Stammer holding the bag, because the US is has this history of dropping its little geopolitical projects when they're no longer useful or they feel like it. I mean, look at Afghanistan, the most recent variation. And these vassals are just going to be standing there looking utterly stupid again.
Well, Greg, thanks for answering that feedback at the start. And for I feel we're pretty well up to date with the scene. And probably a report that you won't hear on mainstream media, actually, because I try and listen out and see what they're talking about. Read this. Not much. And that's why people don't know about it. So, Greg Simons, thanks for coming back on again, Greg, and we'll talk to you again soon.
For sure. Cheers, Paul.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.